Hello everybody, Julian Charles here of themindrenewed.com, coming to you as usual from the depths of the Lancashire countryside here in the UK, and welcome to TMR number 304 for the 15th of our cultural roundtables, in which we are discussing films or other types of production that have some kind of relevance to themes explored on The Mind Renewed over the last decade or so. Although this might be the first exception to that, the exception that proves the rule, so to speak, because I'm not absolutely sure how our film today fits into the TMR canon, as it were, other than to say it's sort of dystopian and, well, it feels right to me anyway. But maybe we'll come up with a reason why we're discussing it as we go along. We're going to be discussing the excellent, bizarre early film by US filmmaker David Lynch called Eraserhead from 1977. And to discuss this particular movie, this cinematic event, we're joined once again by our stellar cultural critics, Frank Johnson in Crazy California, Mark Campbell in Cozy Crayford, and Anthony Rotuno in an undisclosed location in his capacity as fact checker for BBC Verify here in the UK. Gentlemen, welcome back to the TMR roundtable.
Hello.
Thank you. I'm actually going to reveal that I live in Tunbridge. I just want to tell the world. I'll give you my address later.
Okay, very good.
Yeah, why not?
Very good. I think people have been wondering.
So I'm not that far from Mark, actually.
No. I've got to keep that going, though, Anthony. Anyway, so great to be speaking to you all again. So let's do a quick bit of catching up then. So, Mark, I believe you are getting married very soon.
Am I?
I think so.
Yes, I am.
Well, you've certainly invited me, so...
Oh, yeah, that's true.
I hope there's something to go to.
That's true. As we speak, it's in a week's time, yes.
A week, really?
Yes.
Okay, yeah.
So that's already happened by the time this comes out, I suppose.
Exactly. It's in the future now and in the past when you listen.
That's true. It will be, won't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
Gosh, how bizarre.
Yeah. I'll be a changed man. I'll be a changed man.
That's actually quite suitable for our film today, isn't it?
Yeah. I must admit, watching it before and after, when I first watched it, I had no children. Watching it afterwards with children, it's quite a different reading of the film, yeah.
Yeah. Indeed.
Yeah.
And Anthony, how are you doing? Is work going well?
Yeah, very well. I only got three jobs at the moment. I'm a part of the gig economy, I suppose. Just moved flat within Tunbridge, though, which apparently is the second most stressful thing after divorce, and I've never been married, so it's possibly the most stressful thing. No, it all went very well, yeah.
Have you ever been divorced?
No, never been married or divorced, in fact, no. So, going very well, yes. Another fairly successful year in podcast land, so.
Excellent.
Looking forward to this as well.
Very good. And Frank, are you there?
Yeah.
You're there. Excellent.
I'm here.
You've parked your car at long last. You're driving away from...
I have parked my car.
And how is the car? You had a...
I lost my chiropractor. The car is seen better days. Had a bit of a auto accident on Tuesday, and it's about $4,000 worth of damage at least. So,
oh dear.
Trying to coordinate getting that fixed. Quite a bit of drama.
Oh,
yeah.
Sorry about that. But you're okay-ish. I think you said you were driving away from your chiropractor. That suggests perhaps you didn't get away with it absolutely lightly.
Yeah, no, he's got to straighten me out again. Things are a bit tight and sore, and hopefully we'll be on the mend shortly because it sucks having to go to the chiropractor.
Anyway, glad that you're here now and able to talk with us about this excellent film. So let's turn to the movie then. I think we're all familiar with this. I saw it very, very many years ago, I think in the 80s, probably around the same time as Mark. No doubt you'll tell me, Mark, you've got your diary with you. You'll probably say exactly the day that I saw it. Anyway, I'm sure you will. Made a huge impression on me, fitted with my general interest in, you know, modern music, modern art, performance art, and comedy, actually. I've always thought this is hilarious. I'm sure some people think I shouldn't find it hilarious, but I do, in a black sort of way, find it really, really funny. What really appealed to me was a combination of the surreal and the humour, and the black and white somehow. Big thing about it. And the soundscape, you know, coming from musical background. Mm. Soundscape's so important. And I really, really loved Jack Nance since having seen him do this performance.
Mm.
Anyway, your reactions, gentlemen.
I think I'd seen it twice or three times. I think I recorded it off the telly. I tended to do that in the early days and then watch things ad nauseum. But I only watched this two or three times. I remembered the black and white. I remembered Henry and his hair. And I remembered how weird it was. Yeah. I actually watched it last Sunday. And it was kind of perfect because I came home from work. It was about 4 o'clock. I was a bit tired. I was in that slightly hazy state, getting dark outside. And it just sort of worked perfectly for a Sunday afternoon somehow. I think the good and great films, and I don't know whether I'd call this a great film. Possibly I would if I watched it a couple more times. They get better and they get more interesting, and I get into a sort of mode, you know, podcast preparation mode. All the experience seemed to get heightened somehow, and it really did have an effect on me. And true to form with this film, I wasn't quite sure what the effect was. I just knew that it was interesting spending an hour and a half in this world, because it's a very, very unique world. So yeah, very much enjoyed it.
Yeah, I guess everybody has a different experience, a very personal experience whilst watching it. I mean, I agree that when I saw it recently to analyze it a bit for the podcast, it was quite a different experience from the times I'd seen it before. It felt so much more tight. I realized that everything was planned and everything was very deliberate. So even those very long silences and things, they were intended to be there. And I'd always thought they're funny, and they are funny. But, it, you know, and when I first saw it, I thought, oh, this is rambling. I don't think it's rambling at all. I think it's very cleverly put together. Frank.
Yeah.
Do you want to say something about it?
I do.
I think you said last time that you love it. You love this film.
Yeah, I do love this film. It's one of my favorites just because it's so weird and out there. And I don't even know how I came across it. I think, you know, growing up, I'd seen it like in video stores, or like I'd see, you know, Henry's face on the cover, and I'd be like, what is this movie about? And and like I never had any interest to see it. But then I worked with this guy who liked weird movies, and he'd mention Eraserhead every now and then. And I'm like, well, I got to see this. And by that time, like, it was basically like out of print everywhere. I could never find a copy. But, you know, when I moved to California like 6 years ago, one of the libraries here had it. And so I watched it. Unfortunately, I didn't have the chance to watch it before having children. It was after I had children. So, but yeah, I watched it 6 years ago and never watched it again, but always wanted to see it again. And I watched it again for this show, you know, watched some of the extras, some of his short films, and it's all just very weird, unique stuff. But I really like the surrealness of it, the sound design. I'm a big fan of like a dark ambient industrial soundscapes anyways, and just the black and white. I think this movie is like that it's in black and white is just so perfect for this movie. So
yeah, quite an experience. It's hard to imagine what it would be like in color.
No, just one very quick thing. I always love when I find out that something that looks random has been crafted. I think it's something really attractive about that, or something very impressive.
Yes.
I mean, this is not similar, but the music of Frank Zappa, I've become a real Zappa fan, and I'm not comparing it to Eraserhead, but it seems silly and everything, but then you realise there's an intellectual mind behind it. And I don't know whether I'd call Lynch an intellectual, I suppose, maybe, but it's great when something that seems off the cuff isn't. I like that for some reason.
Yeah, I mean, the music in this, I'm thinking of the Fats Waller organ music, seems random.
Yes.
And seems kind of appropriate in its inappropriateness, if that makes any sense. Why are you playing this sort of sickly, joyful music from another era in this context? What sense does that make? And it seems perfect to me, though. So it's obviously deliberately chosen, and yet seems so random. So,
well, just get this in. If I could just get this in now, very, very quickly. It made me think of The Shining, because, you know, there's those Ray Noble songs, you know, midnight, and there's something about jaunty music in a disturbing setting that makes the setting... Right. Yep. Five times more disturbing, you know?
Yes, the contrast. Yes, the irony, I suppose. Yeah, indeed.
Juxtaposition.
Juxtaposition, yeah. That's come up many times in our conversations, yeah. Go on, Mark, you're going to tell me exactly the date that I saw it.
Well, if you saw it live, you would have watched it on Friday the 25th of January, 1985.
Wow. Could well have been.
I think you had a video recorder then, so you might have recorded it. But
might have been both.
Yeah, it was on Channel 4, and in my diary it says, about to watch Eraserhead, so I'll break off. Back again, quite weird film, but extremely boring, ! Wow. Hang on, yeah. No, that's a good thing. Already a break and nothing's happened. Superb. So... So I was really keen on boredom. And then the next day I say, thought about the excellence of Eraserhead, a film which gets better the more I think about it. So I'd really know that the boringness was a really good thing. It was a real compliment.
Yes, you're right, because the boredom is a feature, isn't it?
Yes.
That's the thing.
Totally.
It's like those long silences where people are sat in a lounge and they're not talking to each other.
Yes.
That's boring, but it's the guts to do that. It was astonishing as a filmmaker.
Oh, totally. Mm. And in terms of editing, the way, you know, you'll get a shot of an urban landscape for about 2 seconds, then Henry will walk into view and walk across the screen and walk off, and then there'll be 2 seconds afterwards. Now, most people would
cut
the 2 seconds either side, but Lynch is, you know, deliberately keeping the pace monumentally slow, which is brilliant. And talking about the black and white, I watched it on a little black and white telly, and I didn't know it was black and white. So I think I had a conversation with you or someone else, and they said, oh no, it is a black and white film. Oh, okay, because I thought I was missing something, but obviously it's perfect. I can't imagine it with colour.
No, absolutely not.
Hard to imagine, isn't it?
And do you think with some of those scenes where he carries on where it would otherwise be cut, let's say, by another filmmaker, is that the painter in him lingering on a bit of scene that could in fact, you know, stand alone as a still life kind of thing? Quite a lot of shots feel like that to me.
Yes.
There's one particular one later on with the lady in the radiator has been singing, and the weird thing where his head's on the floor, and I don't know. I'll come to it later, but that all seems like a still life to me, and I just wonder whether that sensibility is there throughout the film.
Yeah, I mean, if we're going to talk about the dreamlike quality, it's just a weird playing around with time almost. You know, when you have a very vivid dream, you might fall asleep and you're asleep for 10 minutes and you wake up and you've had a very vivid dream with a proper story and people you've met, places you've been to, etc. And you think, how could that happen in 10 minutes? And the film almost does a similar thing with the passage of time in there. You're kind of following this person, you're following it, and the sort of the film is over. You think, it feels like a story. It feels like a narrative, but you can't grasp it.
Yes.
You know?
Yes. I think you're absolutely right. Absolutely. Well, do we not find that later on in Mulholland Drive?
Absolutely.
He really goes big on that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And you cannot make sense of it. As you say, characters are swapped and scenes are interconnected with other scenes. This is a narrative, but no, it's not. What was an important bit of the narrative is now the main bit. It can't make sense at all. Just like a dream.
Yep.
So the beginning of that was happening here for sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I have a very vivid dream life. I actually, just as Mark's been keeping a diary, I've been writing my dreams for about 20 years or so.
Oh, wow. Right. Wow.
And I get that a lot. I get two different time periods in the same dream. So I'll often get a kind of Christmas Carol style one where I'm back at my old school, but I know that I'm Anthony from 2023 or 2022 or whatever it is. So I'm not uncomfortable with that in a film. And maybe this is a reflection of film, because if you think about it, film has a sense of reality, but there's all kinds of illusions going on under the surface.
Yeah, and it's very clear that Lynch does describe this as a very dark dream or something like that. So it very clearly is a dream. And there's got to be an autobiographical element to this as well, which we'll talk about in a bit, I'm sure, when we talk about interpretations, meanings of it. At least that much is clear. I've mentioned Mulholland Drive, which is another one I've seen. So that's 2001. I've seen The Straight Story from 1999.
Yeah,
I've seen Dune and Blue Velvet a long, long time ago. The Elephant Man. Anybody seen any other things by him?
Lost Highway, I've seen.
I've seen Dune.
Oh, right. Yeah.
My dad wants me to watch Twin Peaks, and it's on my list because it's David Lynch, but I haven't got around to it yet.
Nor I.
I haven't seen any of the TV series of Twin Peaks at all.
Oh.
Not even one frame of it, yeah.
Has anybody seen Twin Peaks, the TV series?
Yeah.
Oh, you have? Okay.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Probably about 10 years ago now, I had a box set, because I think I'd given up on it when it was on telly, because it's almost willfully surreal. You know, almost like he's saying to people, I'm going to make this so absurd. Skill, you're not going to understand it at all. And I got a bit I found it a bit tricksy, I suppose.
Is it cleverly surreal like Mulholland Drive, or is it just sort of all over the place? Or?
It's a bit odd. It's a bit, I mean, he's in it, plays a character in it, and some of the comedy is so cheesy. You just think, this is, what's he doing here with this comedy? It's so, well, it's a weird mix of deeply disturbing and comedic. And does it work? I don't know. It might be the television format, just it doesn't quite. It's really interesting. It's worth watching, but I'm not sure. And I think also, I can't remember, there was something where he came away from it after about 15 episodes, or it feels like the story finishes and then it carries on for another 8 episodes or so. It's a very strange beast, the TV series.
Do you think there's an element of to create so much material that it lost its quality?
I think he felt like he was either he was burnt out or he was replaced, or I think a committee came and said, well, what is going on here? His vision yes. was sort of watered down a bit in the, perhaps the last third. And then he comes back at the end, and it ends rather extraordinarily nightmarishly. There's a lot in it. There's a lot in it.
Elephant Man's one of my probably all-time favourite films.
It's a great film. Right. Yeah, I love
yeah,
it.
But yeah. I don't think you'd necessarily guess it was a Lynch film, but then when you know it is, you get the industrial settings there, but it's quite commercial for one of his films, isn't it? Or quite accessible, maybe. Mm. I know we're not talking about
that. Yeah, much more coherent than Eraserhead. Yeah.
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 Thank goodness for Mel Brooks.
Absolutely. I didn't. Yeah, I hadn't realised that he was behind the success of Elephant Man.
Yeah.
Yes, he really liked the script, didn't he? And in fact, he didn't know anything about David Lynch, so he wanted to watch Eraserhead, and I think he really liked Eraserhead, and that helped to persuade him to back it.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Mm. Okay, well, I think for probably a large proportion of the audience don't know this film, need to give some sort of indication of what it's about. So I'm going to give a plot summary here, which I'm going to admit that I took the basis of from Wikipedia because I thought it was well written. I thought, I'll cut it down, make it shorter. And then I kept on putting more things in because I thought, well, you've got to explain this, you've got to explain that. So it's actually longer than the piece in Wikipedia. Anyway, so here we go. So the film starts with Henry Spencer, a young man with extremely tall hair and a permanent expression of melancholy, bemusement and resignation, having his face superimposed over the image of a dark and barren planet. Henry opens his mouth and something like a huge spermatozoan comes out. We see a diseased-looking man inside that planet straining to pull three levers, and then the spermatozoan swims off. We next see Henry in industrial wasteland walking home with a bag of shopping. When he reaches the door of his bedsit, he's interrupted by the beautiful girl across the hall. That's her name. The beautiful girl across the hall, who seems to be his neighbour, but they each behave as if they'd never seen each other before. She tells him that his girlfriend, Mary, is expecting him for dinner at her parents' house, so later on he goes there. When he gets there, the conversation is extremely uncomfortable. Long silences, awkward questions, various people having fits, puppies noisily suckling, Mary's father complaining about his knees and grinning fixedly. And to top it all, the chicken dinner seems still to be alive, even though it's cooked. And Mary's mother, after inexplicably trying to kiss Henry, informs him that Mary has had a baby and that they now need to get married, although Mary seems to be unsure that it actually is a baby. Mm. Thus, presumably married, the happy couple, at least for a few seconds, move into Henry's bedsit and start looking after the quote-unquote baby. Or is it? It has a kind of reptilian face, bit reminiscent of that spermatozoan.
Or a very ugly E.T.
Yes, absolutely.
Yes.
Yes, it is. Yes. It's wrapped in swaddling bands up to the neck and cries incessantly, refusing to eat, all of which is too much for Mary, who goes back to her parents, leaving Henry to care for this quote-unquote baby, which instantly becomes ill and covered in spots and sores. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's too much for Henry as well, because he starts to dream, or is it a dream? It's not clear, about a lady living inside his radiator who coyly dances to Fats Waller organ music while treading on more of those spermatozoa, and who sings a weird song about heaven. And he dreams, or, well, no, is it a dream? Well, it's a bit real, is it? Or is it a dream? Don't know. About having an affair with this beautiful girl across the hall, and about his head being replaced by this baby's head, and a child finding his head in the road and selling it to make eraser tips for pencils. Yeah. But fortunately, he snaps out of it. Unfortunately, though, he sees the beautiful girl across the hall with another much older man. So he's very disappointed, and he starts cutting the bandages from the baby's body with scissors, which it turns out, as in all proper nightmares, was the very worst thing to do. The baby has no skin, and so the innards start oozing out, and so he's panicked and confused, and he attacks the inner organs of the baby with the scissors, and all hell breaks loose. The baby fluids leak out all over the place, light fittings spark, and the baby's head grows massively in size. Eventually, the lights burn out and the baby's head sort of becomes that barren planet we saw earlier. And Henry appears haloed by a bright cloud of eraser shavings. Then the planet bursts open and the man inside the planet strains to pull those levers back into their original positions. And the lady in the radiator embraces Henry in a scene of transcendence and bright light. Then there's black silence. Then there are the credits, plus more Fats Waller music again. That's it. Now, if anybody can make any sense out of that, I will be absolutely impressed.
I think even just bright white light followed by dark, that tells you something. I don't know what, but...
No.
Very bright, very dark,
When you sit in front of about 90 minutes of it, it seems less immediately bizarre in your face as that did. Mm. Totally incomprehensible. At least you can get some sense of what's going on when you've actually got time to watch it. But pretty difficult to interpret and maybe uninterpretable. We'll get onto that. Mm. Anyway, let's have some basic things here to start our discussion of it. It was directed by David Lynch, produced by David Lynch. It was written by David Lynch. It was edited by David Lynch with song lyrics to that song In Heaven by David Lynch. And the music was by David Lynch, but also Fats Waller and Peter Ivers. But certainly did a lot to this. But I'm only joking. There are lots of other people involved with this, of course, as well. Mm. It seems like the soundscape was absolutely central to the whole of this, and a guy called Alan Splett, a sound designer, did a huge amount of work on this.
One thing I noticed was not a hissing noise, but that sort of noise. It's actually exactly the same as the noise in 2001 A Space Odyssey when they're in the lunar module.
Yeah.
And, of course, that section of that film, when they're going to Jupiter, is all about loneliness and isolation. So it kind of evoked it in me, you know. They said it took a year. I don't know if that's a year of relentless work. Maybe it was just stretched over a period of time. But, again, you think it's so simple. Yeah, the industrial noises, but clearly it isn't. I don't know. It's just fantastic. I mean,
that took a year, to collect all those noises and to collate them all?
Yeah, the sound effects. That's what I read anyway.
Yeah.
There's a very interesting sort of extra on the DVD that's brilliant because it's exactly the same length as the film and it's Lynch talking. So it's sort of a commentary, but it's not because he doesn't address any of the themes. He does talk very interestingly about the making of the film. And there's one bit I took from that I thought that sort of opens it up for me, the film, is he says, talking about the sound design and talking about, I think, Philadelphia, that's where he grew up. And he says, you can be in a room and feel the exterior.
Oh, I missed that.
Which I just think is so brilliant. That seems key to me that, you know, wherever you are in these tiny, small, enclosed rooms, there is the noise and the atmosphere of this big industrial machine around you. And I think that's right. It's exactly right. Hits the nail on the head that there's claustrophobia, but also there's this idea that you're in this massive, great world, even though you really don't see many people at all in it. And he's only a few characters in the whole film.
I'd watched that same commentary and he said that, the city of Philadelphia was like very inspirational on how he made this movie. He said that city to him had this character where, you could feel the city inside and you could feel all the people who lived around, even though if you don't see them ever, you know. He said it wasn't about Philadelphia, but it was like the city was just such a huge inspiration on how he made this film, he said. Yeah,
that's right.
Very interesting.
It's weird because he didn't have a good word to say about Philadelphia, except that it was hugely important for him. But it's all negative, isn't it? What a dreadful place it was, full of grime and crime. And that's where he was when he was at college, wasn't it, at art college?
It seems bad to say that if you live in a poor area, it's somehow romantic. But I suppose if he didn't think he was going to be living there forever, you know, he was almost passing through, perhaps. I don't know how long he lived there for.
Yeah.
You could see a kind of poeticism in it, couldn't you? I mean,
I think so.
I guess.
Yeah.
The other thing he said was that when he was painting, he would imagine sounds to go with his paintings. I think that was in that scene.
That's interesting.
Maybe it wasn't. I can't remember, but yeah.
He has some videos on the Criterion DVD, actually, that are basically paintings. Like, they're animations, but they're paintings, more or less, that move. And a lot of them have, like, very weird sound designs on them. A couple of them are live action, but, they're all, like, short films. I watched a few of them, and just very strange sounds in them, and then strange visuals. It's sort of like what you're describing there. They're just paintings with weird sounds in them.
It's almost odd watching it again. I haven't seen it for quite a long time, so I rewatched it just before we're doing this. And it's almost, when people talk, it's almost a surprise that people talk because so much of it is in silence. And the whole film could work in silence, really. So when actually characters say things to each other, usually completely bizarre and inconsequential things, for me, it's a bit of a surprise. It's sort of naturalistic thing when this film is so unnatural. Mm. So, so much of it is done with looks and gestures and long moments of...
Yes.
I mean, the word I was thinking of watching this film is awkwardness.
Absolutely.
There's an awkwardness to everybody.
Yes.
To the central character. And it's a kind of weird awkwardness that I have in some of my dreams almost, where you wake up,
right.
You've been in a weird situation where you don't know how to react, like a social faux pas and people looking at you and you're not sure how to behave. And you wake up, thank goodness, it was just a dream. There's just a kind of weird awkwardness to everybody.
Mm.
That and the music, there's a dislocating feel to it, isn't there, when you watch it?
Yes, there is. You don't know what the cause of that awkwardness is in the case of each character, do you? And I was going through my mind was one particular scene where the girl across the hall speaks to Henry and says, oh, and I've had this phone call and you know, Mary's invited you to go to her parents for dinner. And then he reacts by just sort of staring and then goes, oh, yeah? Oh, yeah. You know, like, oh, yeah, that's so strange. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah, very odd.
I think the other thing that grabs you is how robotic the delivery is as well.
Mm.
Particularly, I think it's his girlfriend's mother.
Mm.
I think it's deliberately delivered in that kind of jaded way.
Oh, absolutely.
You're living in this bleak surrounding and like the spirit's gone out of them. You know?
But in a way, it's like... when you're in a sort of dream where you feel like you're controlling it, if you're waking up in the morning, you can go back perhaps half an hour and just drift in and out of dreams. There's a sense almost that they are delivering lines in a play, that you're in a play and you know you're in a play and they're delivering lines of a play and you all feel quite comfortable with that.
Hmm.
So I feel that's part of the dream landscape, really, that they're saying these lines.
Lucid dreaming, you mean?
Yeah, lucid dreaming, yeah.
Yeah.
It's certainly clear that dreaming is very, very important for Lynch. I mean, that certainly came out when I saw that documentary called Lynch Oz.
Yeah,
I wasn't hugely impressed by it, as Mark knows, but I did get a few things from it. And the key thing that I thought was it is clear that the wonderful Wizard of Oz has a big influence upon Lynch. He says that there's not a day that goes by when I don't think about the Wizard of Oz. That's a quote from him. You know, some of the themes that are in that are clearly in his work, and the dream that, of course, Dorothy has when there's that big storm, you know, and then that whole dream transports her to Oz, either in reality or in her dream. That's the open question, isn't it, in the Wizard of Oz. That whole dreaming experience seems obviously important for Lynch. You know, there were some things brought out in that documentary that I thought were illuminating. One was the presence of wind sounds in The Wizard of Oz, where you've got that big storm, all these hissing noises and wind noises, and an analogue to that, of course, is all the steam that you get and the smoke that's in Eraserhead and indeed in other productions. Curtains, we have the curtains behind which, of course, The Wizard of Oz is, you know, the man behind the curtain. Well, there are curtains in this, aren't there, with the lady in the radiator on that little stage with curtains. Mulholland Drive is absolutely full of curtains. So there are these definite connections to The Wizard of Oz, I think.
Twin Peaks too. Twin Peaks.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Twin Peaks is full of curtains, yeah.
Hasn't it also got little red shoes in as well, I think?
I can't remember.
When the Elephant Man, when he's in the Travelling Freak Show, he emerges from behind a curtain, or they pull the curtain to reveal him.
He does.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah.
It's funny, I've never thought of curtains as being sinister, but when I watched the documentary about them, I thought, I suppose they are, certainly in Lynch's world, aren't they? Because you don't know what's behind them.
No, exactly. I think that's what it is. Yeah. It's this the sort of the shift, isn't it, between reality and unreal, the familiar and the unfamiliar, the natural and the supernatural, and the curtain divides that, as does the smoke, and as do the sounds that are the analog of curtains. And I think all of that is that transportation between one and the superimposing of images over each other is another thing he does a lot of, which also happens in The Wizard of Oz, you know. So.
Well, I wonder if the film's getting more and more relevant, because if you think about the online world and AI and everything, someone posted on Twitter, all they wrote was, it's getting harder and harder to know what's real anymore. Or what's true, you know? You feel like maybe this film will grow in relevance.
Perhaps people will increasingly come to think that Eraserhead is real.
Yeah.
Can't distinguish it from reality. I wanted to give a special mention to Catherine Coulson, because she was the assistant to the director, and she seemed to do an awful lot of work, yet she doesn't appear on screen. She was recorded for some scene or other, but it got cut out. Because Lynch cut scenes out, didn't he, after the first official showing? He wasn't satisfied. It was a bit too long or something. He cut 20 minutes out, and I think that went out on the cutting room floor. Mm. But she did all kinds of stuff to assist the director. She was working as a waitress at the time. Mm. She was, you know, an actress. Mm. But she was holding the camera, doing lighting, holding the mic, taking photographs, doing her husband's hair each day, because that was Jack Nance, who was, you know, playing Henry. Mm. She was doing a load of stuff, and she was also donating money from her waitress job to help finance the film. So I think she did an awful lot. Mm. Yeah, it has this definite sense of a communal activity, doesn't it? A communal project, studenty kind of project.
Yeah, certainly looking at the extras, looking at the documentary, yes, that comes over that they years it took to make this thing, but they all seem to have a really good time because I guess they were all working as complete independent people. They had nobody above them telling them, well, Lynch had geared up this fantastic team to do the show. So they were like a sort of hippie. Well, it's a bit late for hippies, I suppose, but you know.
Yeah.
And then they were almost picked up for Cannes, weren't they?
Almost.
He tells a story about that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Didn't quite make
it. In the DVD extra, he talks about how, like, he was talking with some guys who were going to bring it to Cannes, and the day he brought it over, the guys had already left, like, 2 or 3 days before.
He said it played to an empty room, which is very appropriate for the film.
Yes. I think he might have been exaggerating on that. I think he might have meant the people who might have given it the go-ahead just weren't there, and it turned out to be the people who gave it the thumbs down. Mm. Yeah, I mean, the whole atmosphere of the situation where they were, I think, was wonderful. You know, they were in the place called the Stables, weren't they? Mm. Which not just stables, it was garages and greenhouse and maids' quarters and all kinds of stuff, sort of unused buildings that were on the property of a place called Greystone Mansion, which was used by the American Film Institute at the time.
Yeah.
They'd leased it really cheaply, and they were doing a course there. I think they called it the Center for Advanced Film Studies, and Lynch had got a place on that course, but he wasn't really satisfied with that course and then said he wanted to do Eraserhead. And they said, okay, then. at least I think the dean of the center sort of championed his cause, didn't he? And allowed him to do it. I'm not sure he liked the script, but he thought students should be, if they're talented, they should be allowed to do what they want to do. And so they allowed them to get on with this. And he sort of took over this unused set of buildings on the campus somewhere, and they just left them alone to get on with it.
He lived there.
Sorry?
He actually lived in the building too, like when they weren't filming and stuff. Yeah. He wasn't supposed to, but he was doing it, and the guards knew, and they kind of had an understanding.
He actually slept in Henry's room, I think, wasn't that?
That's apparently, yes.
He did, yeah. He actually did.
Yeah.
But they thought it was going to be a short film because the script was so short, didn't they?
That's right.
It was like, well, actually, it's about an hour and a half, but no way.
Yes.
Yeah. It's such an art form, isn't it, to have those silences, just to go back to that, because when I was watching it, man, I didn't get bored at all. I think I've been a bit conditioned. The same with music as well.
It all seems, terribly deliberate, doesn't it?
Mm.
There are these long pauses, but they don't seem self-indulgent in the way that some directors do. You just think, I'll just get on with it. This all seems very, he knows exactly what he's doing, which he obviously does. And it'd be fascinating. Unfortunately, we can't, because I think the footage doesn't exist, but to see what the footage was cut out and see what a difference that makes.
And when there are these long silences, he very often seems to end up that silence with something that relieves the tension in, often humorously, darkly humorously, with a comment that you're not expecting, or inappropriate answer to a question, or something that a question that was asked 15 seconds before, or something like that.
Yeah.
So it does.
When he's asked, "What are you doing now?" He's like, "I'm on a vacation." That's a brilliant line. What do you do?
Oh yes, what do you do?
Yeah, I'm on vacation.
Yes, I'm on vacation. Yes.
And he's a printer, isn't he? Is that relevant?
I think so, because David Lynch worked as a printer of engravings for a short while. So I think there's another key to the autobiographical element of it.
Right.
And his hair goes up like Lynch's as well. So there we are.
There we go. Mm.
There is a thing about it, though, with is it Henry? Is that the character or the actor? That's her character, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the character.
The idea that other than his hair, which is obviously quite memorable, he's supposed to be very bland, like the clothes he's wearing and everything. And I've seen him described either as an everyman or a blank slate, and maybe he's a bit both.
Right.
Like you said, he looks bemused all the time, and it's like he's just allowing things to happen to him.
I've got a bit of a theory about that one, Anthony. Well, I reckon, might be wrong, but you know, is there any significance to the fact that he's called Henry? And I think it fits in with what you just said, because there is a character in The Wizard of Oz called Uncle Henry.
Oh.
And there's a guy called Evan Schwartz who wrote a book called Finding Oz. And in that book, he says that Uncle Henry So this is in L. Frank Baum's children's stories, The Wonderful Wizard of Oz. Okay, so Uncle Henry was based on Frank Baum's father-in-law, Henry Gage, who was, here we go, this is a quote about him. He was bossed around by his wife, a passive but hard-working man who looked stern and solemn and rarely spoke. And I think there's some connection there with the Henry. You know, he's pretty passive, maybe hardworking when he does work. Certainly looks a bit sort of solemn and doesn't speak very much. So kind of makes sense. So I just wondered if, you know, that all hangs together there. Yeah. And I wondered also if that connects to Mary. I don't know, his partner, because there's Aunt M in The Wizard of Oz. Although it's spelled E-M, but, you know, but when you hear it, it's Aunt M. But just a thought. That's a bit tenuous, but I just wondered.
I mean, Henry is a very ordinary name, isn't it? Henry. He's a very sort of like old-fashioned, quiet. Yeah. I'm sorry to all the Henrys out there, but it's not it's possibly not chosen for its exciting connotation.
The people are getting offended, Mark, are their parents.
I'm sorry. I take it all back.
People called Henry who chose their name.
Nothing wrong with Henry.
It's a royal name, isn't it? So it's just an old royal name.
Probably is why he goes by Indiana Jones and not Henry Jones. Yeah. You know?
What about Henry Skywalker? That wouldn't work.
No. Yes. Henry Potter.
Henry Bickle chose.
I think Henry Potter would have worked, actually.
Yeah, actually, that would have worked.
Maybe.
I think Harry is a version of Henry, anyway, isn't he?
Oh, you're right.
Yeah, like Prince Harry is Henry, isn't he?
Oh. Should we say something about the cast then? Go on. No, go on, Mark. Yeah.
No, I was going to ask a question about the comedy in it. I mean, there's some comedy in it that I just wonder whether it's deliberate comedy or whether it's just absurd stuff. There's a bit where Mary's leaving Henry and she goes to the bed and she's sort of yanking something underneath the bed. You don't see what it is. It goes on for ages and then finally pulls out the suitcase.
Yeah.
And you say, what was that? You know,
it is funny.
It's funny.
Yeah.
It's a parallel to what happens in the rubber factory. Do you know where that guy keeps on pressing the bell to get the attention of his boss? Totally gratuitous.
Yes.
There's no point for that at all. It must be funny.
He comes back, doesn't he? He's not allowed into the room with his boss. He comes back and he presses something, gives himself an electric shock or something at the end of the scene. What's that about?
Yes. I know. Think about the humour here. I've said this sort of thing on the podcast before many times, but I know a lot of people do think of humour as being not art and humour as being because it's not serious, therefore it's not good in the same way that art is, you know, and I totally disagree with that.
Yeah, so do I.
I think that comedy is an art form in its own right. I think that's true in here. If you end up laughing within this sort of horrific film in many ways, you know, if you end up laughing at it, that's completely acceptable. And if that's what the artist intends, then it's worked.
Yeah. I mean, going back to 2001, quickly, there's only one joke in the whole film and it's brilliant. You know, the toilet joke is just great. So.
Oh, yeah.
I think, anyway. So
I'll have to watch that again.
Yeah.
Kubrick wrote out all those instructions. Yeah. It's, it's a toilet at zero gravity. And he's sort of pondering, how do I do this?
It's a very good joke.
I was just thinking of my favourite composer, Georgi Ligeti. He wrote this piece for, you know, orchestra with three vocal soloists, and it's called Aventure. And they sing, but they don't sing any words. They just sing noises all the time, like blah, 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 that sort of thing. And you can't help but laugh. And I know he did it. And the audience is trying not to laugh. And that makes it even funnier. And the whole thing was intended that way. And it's not rubbish. You can tell that it's very carefully crafted. But it's funny. So I know. I totally think this is acceptable art, you know.
Well, sense of humor is a sign of intelligence, right?
Absolutely.
You know?
Absolutely.
So what does that say about a lack of a sense of humor?
Well,
that's deep.
I think we all know what it says.
I think so.
Julia, I've just got a few things that may have influenced this film.
Yeah, go on, Anthony.
And then things that it did influence. I mean, I'm sure it's influenced a lot of things, but the two that I read about were Metamorphosis, the Kafka.
Oh, yeah.
Someone wakes up and finds he's a cockroach. And then there's one I hadn't heard of, a story by Gogol called The Nose. Huh. This is a one-line summary. The story of a St. Petersburg official whose nose develops a life of its own and attains a higher rank than him, which I think is hilarious.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
I've got a couple of my own. I don't know if you've ever seen any Buñuel films.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Large Door, absolutely.
Yeah.
Large Door. The only one I've actually ever seen is in Chien Andalou, which is a short film, Andalusian Cat. Mm-hmm. I think the similarity is that it's got these very, the famous one is the razor blade in the eye.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. But it's got real nonsensical stuff, but these really evocative images. Uh-huh. But the other one that really hit me was, have you seen The Trial, the Orson Welles film?
Oh, that's a great movie. I love that one.
Can you see the similarity? Because it is very, very bleak.
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
It's very echoey, and there's connection because that's based on a Kafka novel, and it's a guy who wakes up accused of a crime, and he's never told. He's never told what the crime is, but he suddenly starts to feel guilty or something, and it's Anthony Perkins.
Yeah, well, he gets gaslit by the court system, basically, and then, like, he has to go through all this bureaucratic nonsense typical of Kafka, and he, you know, to try to prove his innocence, he goes and meets with an attorney. And there's, in that story, there's quite a few nonsensical things. There's, like, three guys whipping somebody in a closet, and then there's, he goes and meets with a lawyer, and the lawyer is, like, comically inept or something, or but he comes off as though he's not. And he's giving him advice, but not, it's not practical in any way. It's, yeah, and I thought the Orson Welles one was a perfect adaptation of that novel. Very, very strange and surreal, I'm glad you brought it up, because it does remind me of this movie quite a bit.
Yeah, I mean, it's black and white. You see Anthony Perkins going through these offices where everybody's just typing away. But you just get this relentless typing noise, but they're all in perfectly symmetrical desks, and it's got that sterility, you know, it's got and it's got a lot of echo. So I think if people would like Eraserhead, I think they should maybe seek out that film.
I share your recommendation for sure.
I must admit, Anthony, I did wonder whether Buñuel's stuff, Large Door, or movies by Jean Cocteau had any kind of influence upon Lynch, you know, that sort of thing. But there was a quote somewhere, I can't reference it, but he's something like, before he did Eraserhead, he didn't know about those movies. So I don't know.
That's interesting.
I suppose he had this influence of surreal art and abstract expressionism anyway, so maybe that's how those films would be if you just did them anyway, you know.
There's a couple of Kubrick things. I mean, Kubrick is my favorite director. 2001, I think a lot of directors have said it gave you permission to have long stretches without dialogue in a film that was going to go into the mainstream.
Oh, is that so?
But then conversely, Kubrick apparently, not sure if I believe this, but Kubrick apparently said that Eraserhead was his favorite film of all time, maybe just after he'd seen it or something, and he played it for the cast and crew of The Shining to get them in the mood.
Oh, wow. Right.
All this disturbing stuff. So that's a cool quote.
Wow. Know? Okay. Yeah. That's interesting.
And the only other one was Barton Fink, the Coen brothers. Really, really good film.
Oh, right.
I think they apparently took a lot from this. So, you know, it's what the great thing, isn't it? You take bits from other people and then you influence future generations. Mm. Yeah, it's great.
I've got a copy of that, but I've never seen it. So I'll look at that with interest now. Yeah.
Oh, it's very good. Yeah. It's about a guy trying to write a novel and he's got writer's block. Mm. Shining reference once again. Yeah. See, it all connects. Mm.
Yeah, I wanted to...
Talking about influences. Mm. Oh, go ahead.
No. Go ahead, Frank.
There's another film I saw that's kind of, since we're talking surreal, dreamlike movies, I don't know if it was influenced by this movie or not, but there's a French film called The City of Lost Children by Marc Perrault and Jean-Pierre Jeunet.
And, he made Amelie, didn't he?
Yes, the same guy who did Amelie and Chocolat, I think it was. Yeah, that has a lot of weird... Yeah, Delicatessen, yep, that's the one, yeah.
Oh, yes.
That movie is very surreal and has a lot of weird dreamlike stuff like this and a lot of silences. So I would wonder if there's some inspiration for that movie here, too.
Did anyone calibrate their televisions?
No. That's what it said on the DVD.
I did.
Did you? Yeah. Did it make any difference?
Well, I didn't watch it when it wasn't calibrated. I don't know.
No, all right.
Essentially, it's turning the brightness way down and the contrast way down. And I'm sure that was written by him. There was instructions about how television sets are always set up too high, the contrast too high, because they're counteracting the lights in the showroom. You've got to turn it right down, et cetera, et cetera. It goes through. It's quite a palaver. It's quite amusing in its own way, because you think, well, this is probably David Lynch doing this, and you're sort of following these instructions.
Can I ask Julian a question?
Yeah.
Lynch said Eraserhead was his most spiritual film.
Right.
What does that mean?
Well, now, what does that mean? That's right. Well, that
what does that mean?
Well, that leads us on to what does any of this mean? I mean, I know you can go to all kinds of blogs all over the internet and find different interpretations of this, yet Lynch himself refuses to say what it's about. It clearly has his own interpretation, because he says that nobody else's interpretation is his interpretation. What do you reckon? Have you got any ideas that might, in your view, get close to what's inside his head?
Well, I think in terms of spiritual, I think he probably meant pure, perhaps. Or it was his essence in some way. I mean, there was a one-line summary of the film, Horrific Tale of Unplanned Parenthood.
Yes.
The story of a man who's left to care for his grossly deformed child in a desolate industrial landscape. And I think Lynch, doesn't it come from when he became a father? I mean, obviously, I'm not saying it was as gruesome as this. I'm not saying that, but I think his daughter was born with club feet.
Yeah.
Someone mentioned fear of fatherhood. I mean, this is all quite speculative. It's
yeah, I had seen that interpretation somewhere.
I think that's got a lot going for it. And I was a bit skeptical of it until I found a particular quote by his daughter, Jennifer. So this is from an article in The Independent in 2009. So whoever's writing this wrote, let me just quote this, Jennifer Lynch, an unplanned child was born with club feet. As an infant, she was placed in a cast from the waist down. And I thought, oh, that's a little bit like the child in this thing. Unable to crawl, she would pull herself along, encumbered by a metal bar between her ankles. She eventually underwent surgery. And of course, in the film, Henry cuts open the baby. She underwent a surgery at 4 and wore orthopedic shoes until she was 12. And then she recalls making her mother, Peggy, a birthday present by piling mud onto the dining room table. And of course, there are these piles of mud on the chest of drawers and on the bedside cabinet, very strangely, with a dead tree stuck in it. And then, this is an actual quote here from Jennifer. She says, we packed it tightly and dug little holes and made little clay figures with long arms, and we stuck them in the openings, and that thing stayed there for years. We ate somewhere else. My mum came home and she was like, I love it. And that was normal to me. It never occurred to me that people weren't doing this for each other. So, you know, there's so many little insights there. And I think it's clear that there is an autobiographical element to that. Yeah.
I found the stuff with the, if we're calling it a baby, I found that really poignant. I found that quite tear-jerking, just watching it there wailing and, you know?
Yes.
That was the most emotional part for me. I didn't really find the rest of it particularly emotional.
Didn't you find it also off-putting that it was obviously not a human baby?
Yeah, yeah, I was going to say
it was a reptilian.
Why is it an alien?
Yeah, it's strange.
It's a Nephilim baby.
This is only one interpretation, but the interpretation of alien is something that doesn't seem part of you. So, so maybe I think the bits where the mother couldn't stand the crying, I don't know. I have to tread carefully because I've never had children. I know. I think all three of you have. So careful what I say. But I don't know. You just sense in the character. Perhaps it's a bit of resentment. I don't know.
Oh, the quest for sleep when you've got a baby.
Yes.
Goes above and beyond everything.
Sleep is the promised land, isn't it? Yes.
Drives you nutty. Yeah.
Well, I have been an insomniac, so I can relate slightly.
It's an odd film in the, because I kind of, it seems to me that sort of, on the surface, it's kind of an obvious thing for responsibility, a fear of responsibility of looking after a child on your own.
Yes.
And especially an unwanted one. But it's odd. It seems odd to me. I mean, deliberate, I guess. There's no sense that she was ever pregnant. There's no sense that you see her in the hospital.
Yeah.
There's no sense of the baby coming back. It's just there.
Yeah.
It's mentioned sort of in passing. And then the mother comes on to him. I'd forgotten that. Sort of starts kissing him. It's very odd. And then the next bit, there's the baby. Which is, again, sort of dream logic. You know, you think of something and it's happening. It's happened.
Yes.
You know, you just go with it.
It is very dreamlike in that sense. Yeah, she asks him, you know, have you had sexual relations with Mary? And, of course, he doesn't want to answer.
No.
And then, you know, it's revealed that Mary has had this baby, this thing, which she doesn't seem even clear that it is a baby. And then I notice that Henry says, oh, no, but it's too soon.
Yeah.
You know, as if it couldn't possibly have...
It's just appeared.
Yeah, it's just appeared out of nowhere. Exactly. Yes, he actually says that. Oh, it's too soon or something like that.
And that's what makes it all the more dreamlike. You know, these things happen so quickly, and then he tries to impose some logic on it, and then it snaps back and defies it, you know. It's just like, hey, it's too soon to have a baby, and then suddenly the baby's there anyway, you know.
Yes,
like,
that's a message to the audience, so you try not to make sense of it.
Yeah, maybe.
I mean, I have got another reading of it.
Mm. Well, before we, I won't come to that. It's just that I noticed that his first wife Peggy said that they were both reluctant parents. He was loving, but definitely reluctant. This is the quote. Lynch definitely was a reluctant father, but a very loving one. Hey, I was pregnant when we got married. We were both reluctant, you know? So there's like,
yeah.
I mean, in his case, you know, there's going to be this wanting to get on with the art, and yet you've got the pressures here of parenthood and the pressures of having a disabled child as well. So
yes.
It kind of makes sense, really. Mm. And you might dream or a disturbing dream like that under such circumstances, mightn't you?
I think the alien thing, I think, is just an extension of something that he might have been feeling. Mm. That's what you do in art, isn't it? You take something that's authentic and maybe just exaggerate it or heighten it for effect. And I think that's what he's done.
And I don't know about you chaps, but you do sometimes dream some things that there's no way you would do that in real life or even want to do that in real life. But some of your unconscious is coming up and saying, look, do this. What? No, what? You know, it's nothing to do with me as a rational person here. But, so I can imagine that happening in a dreamlike sense.
And I've read some sort of analysis saying it's not my reading, but he deliberately kills the baby at the end. I don't see that. I see him as essentially being inquisitive. Mm. What's going on? Mm-hmm. I've got to uncover what's going on. And very carefully cutting what he thinks is the swaddling, the wrapping, which in a weird way is somehow connected to the baby. And right at the end with the scissors, I suppose, yes.
Yeah.
He's,
well, there's nothing else to do then, is there? The child's putting it out of its misery because it's just beyond care then, isn't it? Beyond help.
So I don't...
But initially he could have just plunged those scissors straight in without bothering to cut open. Mm. So I agree with you.
Do you want to hear my different reading of the film?
Do. Have you got one? Another one which is plausible?
Oh, well, of course. has anybody seen The Bed Sitting Room, which is this terrible post-apocalyptic 1969 comedy directed by Richard Lester? It's got Arthur Lowe, Roy Kinnear, Spike Milligan, Peter Cook, etc.
No.
I've heard of that, and I like Richard Lester
it's a post-nuclear war satire, and I think this is only because he's got a photograph on the wall of a nuclear bomb, a nuclear explosion. You could read this as some kind of weird post-apocalyptic world in which people are just getting on with things, even though the baby is dying of radiation, is a mutant. The person who's pulling the levers at the beginning of the film is all sort of, he's got stuff on his face, it looks like radiation, it's scars all over his face.
Ooh.
The withered tree, you know, radiation causing the trees to so they're just trying to get on with life in this post-apocalyptic nightmare world. Reading.
It is. It's got something going for it.
Why is there a photograph of a nuclear explosion on the wall? There's no other pictures.
Quite. Why? Exactly. Yes. And why is the environment around so desolate and so few people around? People becoming inexplicably ill.
Yeah. Because it's Philadelphia.
Yes, right. Yeah, well, I can't.
What's on the radiator lady's face as well? What's that supposed to be? Anyone?
No, I don't know. Well, those weird cheeks that she's got, you know.
Yes.
No idea.
It's obviously a deformity thing that he carried on the Elephant Man, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It's very Cronenberg, isn't it? Because he's really into deformity and body horror.
Body horror, that's it, yeah.
And this is really at the heart of the film. To me, is that body horror of being scared of your own, something that's come out of your own loins, essentially, and being scared of it, not knowing what to do.
Mm.
And there's a bit where there's a weird bit where he puts a thermometer in the baby's mouth and pulls it out. It said, you've got 6, these are the numbers on it, 6, 8, and then 100.
Oh, yeah.
It seems to jump from 6, 8, and then 100, and the line is on the 100. and then he turns back to it, and of course it's suddenly got all these horrible pustules. He says, you are sick.
Yes.
It's just a dream jump.
Absolutely.
Jump in just narrative that you get in dreams.
Absolutely. Cuts out the time of reality there and suddenly moves to the next thing. Yeah, exactly right.
Absolutely. Yes. Absolutely.
Yeah, it's one of my favourite scenes, that, actually. Because it's hilarious. Absolutely hilarious.
Yeah.
His delivery is funny. It's hilarious. He delivers that horrible information so hilariously.
Oh, you are sick.
So, yeah, no kidding.
I'm not just sick. I'm as sick as I possibly could be instantly.
Because that's why you need to be in the narrative of the dream. You know, there's no point.
Yes.
You know where you need to be. Boom, you're there.
Yes. Yes.
No. Yep.
That's right.
You know, Cronenberg, some of his early films were in black and white, and some of the student films are full of disturbing imagery, and obviously most of his other films are full of disturbing imagery. So whether he's influenced by Lynch, or I guess they were making films about the same time, weren't they?
Well, I just remembered in the Fly, she has a dream where she gives birth to some kind of grub, doesn't she, or something?
Yeah.
Yeah. Forgotten about that. Yeah.
Oh, dear. And of course, I'm thinking there's no scene of giving birth or pregnancy, but there's that awful scene of where he goes to his girlfriend's house with the parents and they present him with this, what's it, they called it Strangest Damn Chicken, Man-Made.
Oh, yeah, the man-made chicken. That's right.
Like little quail, aren't they? The size of quail, and he has to cut one, and of course it all just bubbles up and stuff. And
Very strange. We'll come to that in just a second because I want to talk about some of the favourite scenes and things. I just wanted one more interpretation that I initially thought, oh, this could be great. You know, I think this could be the key to it. And as I read it, I wasn't convinced. It was the idea of this being a spiritual film in the sense of a Gnostic film. So the idea that the world is all sort of irredeemably bad and the only way of getting out from the world is to realize your sort of inner light, you know, that kind of thing. And it just didn't work for me. The main reason is because this person who wrote this article, which I'll put in the show notes, said that the man in the planet was like the demiurge, the sort of evil lower god who created the physical world. And then the lady in the radiator presents the light that comes from the top god, you know, this sort of thing. But the idea that the man in the planet is like this evil demiurge, I thought, he doesn't strike me as being particularly powerful like a creator at all. It's almost like he's, I mean, when he pulls the levers, he sort of twitches into action like something's controlling him. As if he's pulling the levers of fate rather than being a creator, I thought. Yeah. I read him more like fate.
Yeah.
Dishing out these unfortunate events to poor old Henry, who's reacting psychologically to it. But so I just didn't quite go for that theory.
Mm.
It's more psychological, isn't it, than metaphysical, I think.
Mm. I just had a quick question. What about the child growing? What's that all about? Is that a growing problem? This is where it gets a bit on the nose, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a problem that's growing and growing or something.
At the very end?
Yeah, at the very end, yeah.
I mean, that's weird, isn't it? It's like the head is this vast papier-mâché, quite badly made head that you only see for a few seconds, don't you? Sort of flash frames flashing.
Yeah, and then I've got no idea.
No.
Yeah.
And is it a happy ending? Is it a happy ending or an unhappy ending?
Oh, well, it depends on which theory you go with, doesn't it, I suppose?
He's happy it's ending, probably. Henry is.
I think it's deliberately unanalyzable, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think fear might be just at the heart of the whole thing, perhaps. Mm-hmm. If you had to sum it up in one word, perhaps it's all about fear, I think.
Mm.
That's what I got from it.
Maybe coming to terms with it. Like, I get this sense at the end of the movie that, like, whatever is causing the fear or the kind of heaviness of the film, like, you know, I won't say it's a happy ending, but I feel like it's a relief, you know. It's like, oh, it's I can breathe, you know. It's like, oh, I feel better after when it's ending, you know. Not that I love the movie, but like it's just you feel like a sigh of relief when it finishes, you know.
Yeah, I get the feeling it goes either way. You get white light, don't you, as if it's like in heaven, like the song says in heaven, and then instantly it cuts to black. So you can say, well, this has been relieved, or, oh, it's just as dark and nihilistic as I thought it was to start with. I don't know.
I don't think there's any real resolution. I didn't feel any resolution to it, really. But
no. Not really.
I think as Frank says, as a viewer, although I enjoyed it, you do feel a bit relieved to get out of this bleak world.
Yes, the way
you look to the world if you watch too much of this.
Well, I think that's one of the things I get from this film is it tells me, you know, life isn't as bad as that.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe it is for some people, which is tragic. Yeah. But, you know, when I complain about my own life sometimes, I think, look at a film like this and think, oh, I actually think I've got things really good compared with that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think that in terms of interpretation, you know, there are some key things that we can pin down. I think a lot of the things that we have said are obvious, particularly the autobiographical things. They must apply, surely. Mm-hmm. But in terms of an overall interpretation, I get the impression that he wants us to have our own overall interpretations and there isn't a right answer.
Mm.
And I get that from a quote at the end of that 85-minute interview from the DVD, which you say, Mark, is coextensive with the film.
Yeah.
He spends the whole time deliberately avoiding what it's about.
Mm.
And then right at the end, this is obviously deliberately crafted because it's the last sentence, I believe, he says, "It is a personal film and no reviewer or critic or viewer has ever given an interpretation that is my interpretation since the, you know, 25 years or so that it's been out." And I thought, well, that's actually cleverly worded because he could have said, no one has ever worked out my interpretation.
Yeah.
He could have said, no one has ever come close to my interpretation. But he said, no one has ever given an interpretation that is my interpretation. And maybe that's the point, you know?
I mean,
we've each got our own interpretations. And by definition, nobody can ever give my interpretation because it is my interpretation, just as yours is yours. Well, I reckon that's a key to what he means with it.
Well, there's two things that artists always say. When I say artists, could be filmmakers, musicians. Mm. Number one, once it's out in public, anyone's interpretation is as valid as anyone else's. Mm. You know, it belongs to the public, if you like. Mm. And the other thing, I think we're presuming that he knows what it's about. Maybe he doesn't. I mean, maybe he just, if you think about the creative brain, sometimes maybe it runs away with you.
Yeah.
But he probably does have an interpretation. I'm just saying.
Well, he says he has.
Yeah, I suppose he says he has. But I'm just saying that sometimes I think the artist may not actually know what things are about, but they put it out there anyway. Mm. But you're right. In this case, he has said.
I agree that he probably doesn't have an answer to any question about every detail inside it, especially if it's very dreamlike in conception.
Well, perhaps his interpretation is he doesn't have an interpretation.
There you go.
I'm sure he's playing with us, but, you know.
Yeah, he seems like a bit of a trickster to me in a kind of sly way, you know?
Yes, I think there's
with the humour and everything. Yeah. Very good. Can I just ask you about the sound effects? How did it make you feel and how do you think they made them? What was going on like when... Oh, can I just look at my notes for a sec?
Well, while you find that, I will say that while I was watching it again, we had a box of vegetables that had been delivered. And inside it, there was a mouse eating, you know, chomping away at the vegetables. And I didn't know what that sound was. I was looking at the screen. Mm. I put this box down on the table. I was looking at the screen and I could hear this. And at that moment in the film, I thought, what a strange noise to have. But that works, doesn't it? And then I realised... Hey, just a minute, that noise is coming from inside the room. And then I found it was a mouse. So there you go. How strange was that?
That sounds like something out of a Razorhead.
Yes.
There you go, yes. Julian, you're living it.
Mm.
Yeah. Mm. What did you do with the mouse?
I rescued it and put it outside.
Good, good.
Yes.
I still can't find it.
Oh.
Did someone like rub their cheek or something like that? There was a really bizarre noise. Can't find it. Never mind.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, that was it. She rubbed her eye.
Oh, yes. Very
odd.
Yes.
Mary rubbed her eye. It made this incredibly loud.
Oh, horrible. Yeah.
Really disturbing noise.
Mm.
And that chicken as well. Oh, very disturbing, isn't it?
Yeah, on my rewatch, I found it much more disturbing than I remember when I first saw it.
Mm.
First saw it, I was almost chuckling away at it, thinking, you know, what a strange film this is. And then 40 years later or so, I think, oh, gosh, actually, it's quite disturbing on a quite a deep level. You feel like you want to shake it off afterwards and go off and do something jolly.
Well, I think this became a kind of quite midnight movie, didn't it? That gets shot in cinemas. And
it did.
I think that would make a huge difference. I think if you watch this in the light on midday or something, you might find it funny. But then if you watch the same thing at midnight, I remember watching a film at Glastonbury. I watched Blair Witch Project at 1 o'clock in the morning in the cinema outside at Glastonbury, and it was really disturbing. Yeah. That makes a difference, doesn't it?
It does.
Definitely, actually.
Yeah. Mm. Okay, what about favourite scenes? Has anybody got a favourite scene?
Yeah, I can't really think of everything. I think of it just more as the overall experience, really.
Well, let me start it off then with the basically the scenes, the collection of scenes where he goes to visit Mary's mum and dad. I just love that. I think it's fantastic.
Mm.
There's just so many aspects of that. It's so uncomfortable. Everybody's so unfriendly. Well, I suppose Mr. X is overly friendly. Mrs. X is not friendly at all. Mm. All those silences, the weird suckling sounds of these puppies. You don't know what it is to start with, do you? And you eventually see them there in the corner. And then that weird conversation about what do you do and I'm on vacation and all that. And the weird fits that people have for no apparent reason.
Yeah.
It's all so odd. Mm. And then you get this business, as you say, with the chicken for dinner, which are too small to carve, but Bill says, you know, Mr. X says, why don't you carve it? And he agrees to carve it. And then they're still alive and the blood comes out. And that weird scene in the kitchen with the grandma character.
Oh, yeah.
She's obviously senile, really far gone.
Yes.
And yet Mrs. X gives her a bowl of food to mix. She's totally incapable of doing it herself. So she holds her hand, gives her the spoons and does it for her.
Yeah.
She's totally unaware of this. And then she lights a cigarette for her afterwards. I mean, that's just so odd.
Yes.
But that whole collection of scenes there I thought was hilarious and odd at the same time. Lovely. I'm just sort of staring at the screen saying, how does this make any sense? What's going on and then laughing at the same time.
I think
and I sort of agree with Anthony in a sense that it's such a homogenous unit and it's kind of hard to pick out a favorite scene. But I suppose if there was a scene in there that for me encapsulated the film, it would be on that little sort of strange theatre set behind the radiator, where he's going and standing almost behind a witness box or something.
Yes.
He's putting his hands on the bars. And then his head pops up.
Yeah.
A thing shoots out from his neck.
That it's the baby, isn't it?
Then the baby.
Yeah.
His head, it's the baby, yeah.
His head sort of rolls on the floor. Then the camera sort of, then you get a shot of all the components of the woman there, the little strange things she stepped on.
Yeah.
The floor, you know, that checkerboard floor,
yes,
the curtains,
yes,
and him standing there. And it's just, whoa, this is just, what human being could put all these images together in the same shot but him?
Salvador Dali is the answer to that, I reckon.
Yes.
That's what
yes,
it is. I mean, yes, it was like right, a tableau, wasn't it, of a Dali painting at that point. I thought that was beautiful. I loved that.
Yeah,
If you looked at that without knowing the film, you would think these things were totally disconnected.
Yeah.
But with the narrative of the film, it kind of makes sense, but doesn't make sense.
Yeah,
You know why they're all there.
Yes, yeah.
And that you know that mound that's next to the bed on the bedside cabinet that's got the twig sticking out?
Yeah.
That appears in that scene, doesn't it? It comes on wheels.
Yes, you're right.
It comes onto stage on wheels. Yeah, yeah.
This must be a big favourite of film school, surely, right?
Oh, it must be.
I mean, you could spend months analysing it, couldn't you?
Yeah.
What do you think?
I think you could. And then everybody would say everybody's interpretation is correct.
Yeah.
Well, to end with, I don't know what I can learn from it, except what I said before, just as a cathartic thing, that life isn't as bad as that.
Yeah.
I was used to be very much attracted to surreal things when I thought that the world was totally incoherent and I had no faith. But although I'm still attracted to surreal things, I don't see that in the same way. I don't see it as nihilistic and negative as I did before. And I don't know where Lynch is coming from in that respect. He doesn't strike me as nihilistic. He's very interested in TM. He's been into TM for very, very many years.
Yeah.
He's got a foundation where he wants to, you know, help people. You know, so I get the impression that it's not coming from that, oh, the universe is, you know, completely irrational sort of angle. It's a job to know what the message of it is, really, if there is a message.
I think the viewer can just take from it. I don't think there's a universal message, but just going back to dreams, I mean, I often wake up from dreams, pretty vivid ones. This sounds really corny, but I get a kind of a life lesson from them sometimes. And often I've had very dark dreams. And as soon as I wake up from them, before I've had any chance to think, I almost get a message from my subconscious saying, be happy, you know, realize how lucky you are, you know. And I think, just to get political for a sec, if you look at what's happening in Gaza, I mean, just be happy you're not there.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Maybe it's just, you know, I think we should always try and get something positive from anything, you know, because the world's hard, as we know, but it's gratitude.
No, that's interesting, because I've heard that as a justification for horror filmmakers tend to say that the reason we love horror is because it's sort of making you realize, oh, thank goodness we don't have to go through that. Thank goodness there isn't a monster outside. It's cathartic. It makes you value your life. And in a way, this is it a horror film? I mean, you could read it as that.
Could do.
You know, think, there's elements
I
there.
I think it is, yeah. I think
so.
It's
in that sense, that sort of makes sense that you've watched this and go, oh, gosh, and probably Lynch himself, thank goodness my life didn't turn out like that. Or, you know, it could have done. And there are elements in it, as you say, that are autobiographical. I don't really see any link between him and the central character, certainly in terms of their personality. But, you know, you could go down that one route, which is the Eraserhead route. And I think it's just to sort of say, well, that's not your life. So be happy, as you say.
that's quite a thing, really.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
No, I think gratitude is so important, you know.
I think that's right.
So, you know, why not take something life-affirming from it, you know?
Yes, very true. Frank, it's unfair to give you the last word on this one. We've used up all the ideas. Do you have anything anything to add? Or
not really, no. I mean, I can't really think of a favorite scene or anything. I like Mark's one where his head pops off and the baby's underneath. But if I had to pick any specific part, I would say, because it seems the most out of place to the rest of the film, is the machine that's making the erasers and or, you know, the pencils and stuff. I'm not really understanding how that fits into the rest of the story. But I don't know. That part to me stands out the most.
It's odd that Lynch himself says he doesn't know where he got the title from or the idea from.
Yeah.
But obviously that is part of the idea, isn't it? That the head and the eraser go together there. But
yeah,
where he got it from, well, he claims not to remember.
Yeah, I mean, one interpretation that I think is too on the nose is something about erasing the responsibility, but I don't know.
This is it, isn't it?
It might be one of those things where it just came to him and he went for it.
Yeah.
We've all had moments where we've had dreams where you wake up and think, I would never have thought of that in a million years, conscious, but dreaming, you put all these bits together.
It's true.
I will second that. Yeah, I had a dream once where I was like at the cafe inside of a bookstore.
Yeah.
And there was some black lady there nearby at a table, like standing, doing something. And then she looks up at me and tells me, oh, you know, you need more hydrogen in your diet. I'm like, what the heck does that even mean? Like, what does that mean? You know, and it's like just totally nonsensical and not something I would have ever thought of in waking life ever.
Yeah.
So. And it's highly possible that a lot of these ideas came from Lynch's own dreams. And those are part of that interpretation that he's not going to tell anybody else because they're deeply personal to him. And fair enough.
Right.
Wow. Well, thank you very much, gentlemen, for coming to discuss this extremely odd film.
Yeah.
As you said, Anthony, I think earlier on, we could go on talking about this forever. We've said a lot, and I think we've made as much sense of it as we can. I still can't directly connect it to everything else at TMR. As I said before, maybe the dystopian aspect of it, maybe just my own interest in the surreal. It's a film that I wanted to talk about, and I know it appealed to each of you. So thanks very much for coming on and having this conversation.
You're welcome. Thank you.
It's been like the film. It's been quite mind expanding, this conversation.
Yes, indeed.
Ideal Christmas movie.
My imagination going.
Yeah, thank you.
Oh, yeah, the ideal Christmas movie. That's right. Yes. Well, I do recommend people to go and look at it if you can get a copy, but don't watch it late at night. I don't think it's a good idea.
Watch it during the day as a comedy and watch it late at night as a horror film.
Yes. Yeah. Watch it on Christmas morning. How about that? Well, thanks very much, chaps, for talking about this very odd film.
Yeah, thank you.
Very much enjoyed it.
You're welcome. See you next time.
Thank you. Take care.
Show notes for this program can be found at The Mind Renewed, themindrenewed.com. Podcast music by the brilliant Anthony Rajkoff, attribution non-commercial share alike 4.0 international. You have been listening to me, Julian Charles, and my guests, Frank Johnson, Anthony Rotuno, and Mark Campbell. And I very much look forward to speaking to you again in the near future.